Edward Miguel, TED, is a professor of economics and the director of the Center for Effective Global Action at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 2000. Prior to that, he has his undergraduate degree in math and economics from MIT and a PhD in economics from Harvard. TED's main research focus is African economic development, including work on the economic causes and consequences of violence, the impact of ethnic divisions on local collective action, and interactions between health, education, and productivity for the poor. He has conducted fieldwork in Kenya, Sierra Leone, Tanzania, and India. TED is a faculty research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Economics, Journal of Development Economics, and Review of Economics and Statistics. He's also the recipient of the 2005 Alfred P. Sloan Fellowship and winner of the 2005 Kenneth J. Arrow Prize, awarded annually to the International Health by the International Health Economics Association for the best paper in health economics. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Ted Miguel.
Thanks for the introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to start off with about 20 or 25 minutes overview of the topic of economic trends in sub-Saharan Africa before I think turning to a discussion, open discussion with you all. Sub-Saharan Africa gets a lot of bad press, or at least till recently got a lot of bad press. I'm going to talk about changes, important changes in the economic climate in sub-Saharan Africa. So the first thing I want to point out and show you some numbers on is the economic turnaround in sub-Saharan Africa since about 2000. There's been a real change in Africa's economic prospects, and actually income levels and economic growth are at historic highs since about 2000. So the question I want to pose is Africa sort of on track to become the next economic miracle following some Asian cases? The discussion today will draw on a book of mine from a couple years ago with MIT Press called Africa's Turn and a recent foreign affairs article on the same topic. By around 2000, sub-Saharan Africa was coming off an awful few decades. From the 70s to about 2000, from 1975 to 2000, per capita income levels fell by about 20% in sub-Saharan Africa in per capita terms. So this wasn't restricted to one country or another. It was almost continent-wide. There was this decline. India and China actually had very similar per capita income levels to sub-Saharan Africa in the 1970s. From the 70s to 2000, they took off economically, tripling, quadrupling per capita income, while income levels actually fell in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, beyond the economic decline and also just interrelated to it were health crises, the HIV/AIDS epidemic, a rash of civil wars. The proportion of African countries experiencing civil war in the 80s or 90s was about two-thirds. Genocide in Rwanda, and on and on. There were very few democracies in sub-Saharan Africa in the 1980s. But things changed quite dramatically since around 2000. I'm going to mention the case of Kenya because it's a place that I've worked, and it makes some of the changes concrete. Since 2000, Kenya, like the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, has had very rapid economic growth. The macroeconomic policy environment has been much more stable since about 2000 than it was in earlier periods. Inflation is much lower. Budget deficits are under control. Foreign investment's been rising. And there have been successful reforms, changes, and progress in a number of important sectors. So in Kenya, tea, coffee, and tourism were traditionally very important sectors, and they've done well since 2000. But Kenyans have moved into new sectors in important ways. So the flour industry has boomed. There's a multi-million dollar industry in fresh cut flours, where there are daily overnight flights to European markets. That's been a big sector in Kenya, Ethiopia, neighboring countries. Telecommunications. There's been a revolution with the spread of the cell phone in Kenya and in other African countries. The cell phone has given people access to markets in a way they didn't have before. There's also been a lot of innovation in Kenya in this sector. So the earliest successful case of mobile money transfers and mobile banking is the famous M-Pesa program in Kenya, which now has been copied in dozens of countries. So there's been innovation in those centers. There are call centers, and Kenya has solidified its position as a regional manufacturing hub during this period. But the progress didn't just take place in some factories around Nairobi. It was really nationwide. The part of Kenya where I work, where I've been working since I was in grad school in the late 90s, is a remote western district in Kenya called Busia, right on the Ugandan border. And I visited there every year since 97. So it's been really interesting for me. I've been able to see firsthand the evolution of a particular kind of no-name district capital for 15 years now. And the transformation is stunning. In 1997, almost no private homes had electricity. Of course, there were no cell phones. There were no banks in town, or there was one bank that was impossible to access. Political openness has changed in Kenya. In 1997 was actually an election year where the incumbent at the time, Daniel Arap Moi, rigged an election, and the change in political openness is striking. I'm going to put up this graph to illustrate some of these changes. The red line there is the trend in per capita income in Africa as a whole, all of sub-Saharan Africa. So we've excluded North Africa here, which has different, very different income levels, different history. The blue dotted blue dashed line is Kenya. Now you can see Kenya sort of follows the Africa-wide trends. The immediate post-independence period in the 60s and early 70s was a period of moderate growth, but it was positive, about 2% annual per capita income growth. But the mid-70s to about 2000 were a period of decline, with average declines of 1% per year. The last decade has seen a very sharp turnaround, where growth's been faster than it's ever been before. And in fact, now per capita income levels in sub-Saharan Africa are higher than they've ever been. So I want to go through a couple of the main potential explanations for the turnaround. And these tie into, I think, some interesting geopolitical issues, especially when we talk about the role of relations with Asia, which has been a striking, noteworthy part of the change. Let me start with a discussion of education. No discussion of Africa's turnaround, I think, would be complete without noting the important changes in literacy rates, in human capital and education that have occurred in sub-Saharan Africa. So even during the otherwise lost decades of the 70s and 80s, there was rapid expansion of school systems in most parts of sub-Saharan Africa. There are some exceptions. Several of the Sahelian countries in West Africa still have abysmal schooling levels. But outside of those countries, there's been rapid progress. So literacy rates in 1970 in Kenya were about 30%. Today, they're about 90%. Kenya's moved towards universal primary education. Actually, a lot of African countries have made that sort of policy a priority. One of the other noteworthy things about education in most sub-Saharan African countries, again excluding these Sahelian West African countries, is women's progress in education has been almost equal to men. So in Kenya today, school enrollment rates have narrowed between men and women. There used to be a gap a few decades ago. They've really narrowed. So there still are gender gaps in education, but they're a lot narrower than they were, and a lot narrower than many other parts of the world, for instance, Middle East, South Asia. What does this give sub-Saharan Africa? The most obvious thing is a more educated workforce will be a more productive workforce. There's simply whole new sectors the economy can go into with an educated workforce. That's an obvious benefit. But there's a couple of other benefits. One that a number of observers have noted is elected leaders, ministers, technocrats are much better educated in sub-Saharan Africa in 2012 than they were in the 70s. There's just a growing cohort of educated individuals. Central bank governors in sub-Saharan Africa in the 1970s tended not to have the greatest qualifications. They do today. The central bank governor of Tanzania, Benno Ndulu, is a PhD in economics from Northwestern. He was a World Bank official. He's published in good research journals. He's a serious economic thinker. When the economic crisis of 2008-09 hit, it was good that he was in charge of the Central Bank of Tanzania rather than someone with a lot less preparation in economics. Beyond the benefits for policy, there are also potential political benefits. It's much easier to organize a literate population than one where literacy is rare. And really, it creates the foundation for a functioning democracy. The second element of change in sub-Saharan Africa is democracy. So a noteworthy pattern that you may be familiar with is the increasing democratization of African countries. So in the 1980s, there were almost no democracies in sub-Saharan Africa. Today, the majority of African countries have had multi-party elections. They're often imperfect elections. The ruling party has an advantage, but there's some competition, and there are a number of countries where there's been alternation of power from ruling parties to the opposition. The media in the African countries I visited is freer and more active and livelier today than it's ever been. All of those things tend to reinforce democratic reforms. Steve Radelet, who's the chief economist of USAID and also a longtime researcher on African issues, has found in the data that countries that democratized faster since the 90s have experienced faster economic growth. Now, this is a debated issue in social science. Researchers go back and forth about the economic growth benefits of democracy. It's not a settled question. But at least among African countries in the last couple decades, the correlation is very strong. So there's really some evidence that democratic reform may have helped improve growth. If democratic governments are more accountable to the population, they may end up choosing policies that benefit the population more. So there's some good reasons to think democracy could lead to better policy. This is the same kind of plot I showed you before. Again, the red line is Africa, the blue is Kenya. Higher up on the graph here, the vertical axis, that's associated with better measures of democracy. This is the Freedom House Index you may have heard of, which measures how democratic a society is. So a 1 there on top would be the US. A 7 is an absolute authoritarian, totalitarian dictatorship. African countries on average in the 80s were around a 6. And now they're closer to a 4. So sub-Saharan African countries haven't become Sweden, but they're a lot more open than they used to be. Opposition parties are usually legal. Opposition radio stations are usually legal. And there's more open space for policy experimentation and accountability. The third point that's often raised or as a contributor to Africa's economic turnaround is the growing ties sub-Saharan African countries have with Asia. And this is a really stunning change over the last decade. In around the year 2000, trade between China and the countries of sub-Saharan Africa was minuscule, a couple $1 billion a year. Today, it's over $100 billion a year. It's just been a massive change. A lot of the trade, and I'll show you a graph in a minute, a lot of the trade, the African exports to China have been commodities. And it's certainly the case that growing Asian demand in China, in India, in other Asian countries for raw materials, for oil, for copper, et cetera, has been a big part of this trade and driving the trade. That demand has also pushed up global commodity prices. Since about 2002, we've seen this upward trend. In addition to trade, Chinese companies have invested very heavily in these sectors in sub-Saharan Africa, really in the energy sector, mineral sector, as well as in transportation infrastructure and telecommunications infrastructure. You know, so in Nairobi right now, there's a huge Chinese construction firm building a ring road. The same story is repeated throughout the continent. This rise in relations with Asia has captured a lot of attention. And sort of one striking fact is last year, in the second quarter, the last quarter where I could find complete data, the three leading source countries for foreign direct investment in Africa were actually in Asia for the first time. The U.S. came in fourth. So they weren't, you know, the usual suspects of Britain, France, and the U.S., which are the traditional three largest investors, private investors in sub-Saharan Africa. They were China, India, and Taiwan. So things are changing very quickly. And, you know, there are implications for U.S. global economic leadership, in the sense that a growing share of this trade is actually settled in yuan rather than in US dollars. This is a graph like those I've shown you before, sort of changes over time in trade. And the main point is just the trade has skyrocketed. This is African exports to China from the mid-90s to 2010. And I'm sorry that the font's a little small, but you can see that the vast majority of African exports, the red line and that blue line right below it, the red line is total exports, the blue line are primary commodities. So that's really the vast majority of exports to China. This is the reverse direction of trade, Chinese exports to sub-Saharan Africa, and there the bulk are manufactured goods. So it's a pretty interesting, I think this conforms with what you might have thought, but the main thing is just how striking this rise has been, and how it shows no signs of slowing down. There was a little bit of a blip in 2009 with the global crisis. Why have Chinese firms been doing so well? Well, first of all, a lot of this trade is driven by demand in China for raw materials. That's clear. But why have Chinese energy and mineral companies been so successful? They may have a natural advantage over US and European countries. They're used to working in China, a setting with poor rule of law, corruption, bad infrastructure, all those things. That's their environment. So if they go into another less developed setting, another global South setting, they have a leg up on firms. There's another advantage, in quotes, that they may have, which is there's going to be a lot less domestic scrutiny of their activities than there would be of US and European countries working in sub-Saharan Africa. And that has led to some of the negative and well-publicized byproducts of African involvement in Africa, Chinese involvement in Africa. So there are well-publicized cases of terrible worker safety precautions taken in Chinese mining firms. There have been several major mining accidents in Zambian copper mines. Hundreds of workers have died in Chinese-owned mines. If that had happened to a US or British firm investing in Zambia, there'd be tremendous public outcry. Of course, there are mining accidents in China all the time, so it's not clear that the Chinese firms are treating African workers any worse than they treat their own workers. China has become diplomatically tied to and supportive of major human rights abusers, Sudan, Chad, Zimbabwe, and linked to major government corruption scandals. So there's a well-known scandal 2 years ago in Namibia related to bids on a contract. Is the rise of China weakening U.S. influence? Here, I think it's pretty hard to answer that question. There's so many things changing at once. My inclination is to say probably not. If sub-Saharan African countries were becoming richer, more democratic, more confident, even without this sort of Chinese involvement, my guess is they'd become less reliant on the US and Europe anyway over time. So it's not clear that it's a zero-sum game, the way it's often made out to be. Okay, the last point I want to discuss is Africa's population. Everybody knows sub-Saharan Africa is the world's poorest continent, so in that sense has the greatest potential for growth. That makes it a very interesting market to get into or to think about, because there's tremendous scope for growth. Beyond that, and something that's a bit less well known, is it's also poised to be the most populous region of the world sooner than you might think, or than most people might think. So here are population trends, 1960 to 2060. Now obviously, the 1960 to 2010, that's real data. Beyond that are projections, United Nations population projections. But I've taken what are called the medium projections or the middle projections, which are meant to be rather conservative. So you can see from 1960 to 2010, China has the greatest population. India is sort of catching up. The US and Sub-Saharan Africa is the red line. The US is the yellow line. Started out at about 6% of world population in 1960. The US is gradually, about 200 million people. I'll show you the percents on the next slide. The US is gradually increasing. Sub-Saharan African growth has been incredibly rapid. But what you'll see here is in about a decade, India will overtake China as the world's most populous country. And a couple decades after that, Sub-Saharan Africa will overtake both of them. So by the time we get out to 2060 with these rather conservative projections, there will be 2 billion people in Sub-Saharan Africa. So there'll be a doubling of population in Sub-Saharan Africa when, because of the demographic transition, population growth in China and India is going to start slowing down. So this is even more dramatic in this next figure, which shows each region as a percentage of world population. So here you can see China is already declining quite rapidly as a percent of world population. This is really the product of the one-child policy. So you have a very rapidly aging population in China and a soon-to-be shrinking population. And they're already shrinking as a share of world population. But if current trends continue, by 2060, sub-Saharan Africa will be almost a quarter of the world's population. Just a huge change from what it was in 1960, where it was about 7 or 8% of world population. So just leaving aside its growth potential, the market we're talking about is going to be huge. And it's just sub-Saharan Africa is going to be an increasing share of humanity, something we can't ignore. So let me just wrap up, and then we'll turn to questions. The kind of punchline of the talk is sub-Saharan Africa can no longer be dismissed as a basket case. Sub-Saharan Africa isn't a region we should equate with failure on all dimensions at all times the way people did till pretty recently. So in the academic sphere, and you know, the 1990s, around 2000, there was a cottage industry of Afro-pessimism, people said. Everybody, you know, every scholar was competing with the next to list all the reasons why sub-Saharan Africa was a failure in terms of health, democracy, economic development. That's no longer the case. There's been a big change in Africa's economic prospects, a big opening up in terms of democratization. And looking forward, if we think about private sector investment, we think about potential future markets, sub-Saharan Africa is a really interesting, important region because of its population growth, because of its economic growth potential. And the changes in governance, the institutional reforms, the political opening probably makes it a lot more, hopefully will make it a lot more stable region as well going forward. So the fraction of African countries experiencing civil war has fallen a lot over the last decade. That's one indication of the changes. Thanks.
I'm president of Village Enterprise. We do microenterprise development work in East Africa. And I found your presentation very interesting. You focused mostly on the positive trends in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'd like for you to address the issues that we face as an organization working with people in extreme poverty. The two issues that I see that could potentially have a negative impact on Africa's economic growth are the lack of infrastructure. We work out in the rural areas, and it means that we have to pretty much rely on dirt roads to get to the areas that we work. So infrastructure is a huge problem, both transportation infrastructure and energy infrastructure. And then the second issue is that half of sub-Saharan Africa, half of the population still lives in extreme poverty. So if you could address those two issues and how you feel those issues need to be addressed in order to have sustained economic growth.
Sure, thanks. Should we go ahead?
Go.
Yeah. Great, thanks for your comments. I certainly was emphasizing the positive, kind of the little bit of the framing or the focus. There are a lot of threats to this progress in sub-Saharan Africa, which I didn't get to. People have definitely talked about climate change is a very important threat, especially in particular regions, Sahelian West Africa and certain parts of Southern Africa. You put your finger on two critical issues. The lack of infrastructure has been highlighted as one of the key bottlenecks and constraints on growth. It's estimated, you know, the World Bank comes up with these numbers, I don't know what they, you know, where they come from exactly, but they estimate that something like $70 billion a year in infrastructure investment is needed to accelerate African growth. It's certainly an issue. There has been a rise in this sort of infrastructure investment, both in the power sector and transportation infrastructure over the last decade. You know, as part of this, these changes, whether they're sufficient, I think, is still a little bit unclear. I know those roads in Kenya and Tanzania, and it's not good for one's, you know, back or health to bounce around those roads. In terms of power infrastructure, I think there are a lot of unexploited opportunities for hydropower, renewables like solar power that I think are being explored. The point on extreme poverty is a great one. I was going to put a slide on trends in extreme poverty, and I sort of cut it at the last minute. During the 70s, 80s, 90s, up until about 2000, the proportion of people living in extreme poverty in Africa was rising as
incomes were falling, so that made sense. And it was about 50%. Now, in the last decade, it started to, you know, crawl downward. So there has been, you know, the beginnings of improvement there. And I think some of the positive developments for helping the extreme poor, well, there's a few positive developments. One is, you know, the push towards universal primary education and elimination of school fees in a lot of countries will probably benefit the extreme poor more than other groups if it does give them access to basic basic education. There's still obviously a lot of public health issues that need to be addressed as well. Another major set of policy reforms that affect, I think, benefit some of the extreme poor has been the agricultural, the liberalization of agricultural markets since the 80s or 90s. So the price African farmers get for their products as a share of the world market price has tended to rise, not everywhere, not for every crop, but it has tended to rise with that marketing reform. So, you know, agricultural marketing boards in the 70s and 80s were notorious for basically squeezing farmers in rural areas. So I think in education, agriculture, there have been some positive reforms that are going to tend to help that group. But we're just seeing the beginnings of an improvement for them. And I think the data suggests it's just, you know, one or two steps out of 10. So it's certainly a key challenge.
Okay. Get ready. I'll ask a question while you're going to the mic, if I may. You know, the stat that really shocked me was that the fact that sub-Saharan Africa could become the largest population within, arguably, my lifetime. And is there any sense of an inflection point where the same trends that we've seen in China and India could become? And I wonder, because the other link that you have is education, particularly education of women, is the one that leads towards improvement in and decline in rates of population growth.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So, right, all the data suggests more educated women have fewer kids and healthier kids, actually. So they're sort of investing more in quality than quantity, or, you know, that's how economists would put it. The trends I showed you were meant to be conservative trends. They actually take into, they assume there will be some declining fertility in sub-Saharan Africa going forward. If I showed you the most conservative, depends what you mean by conservative, but if I show you the trends that assume there's going to be the sharpest drop in fertility in sub-Saharan Africa, sub-Saharan Africa is still poised to become the most populous region. So I think it's quite plausible under a wide range of assumptions that they will be the most populous region in the coming decades. It's been striking, observers have found it striking that their fertility hasn't fallen that much yet. It hasn't fallen as much as some other countries that experienced rapid growth. Certainly not nearly as quickly as China, right? But China had this draconian policy that pushed things forward. So in the absence of a policy like that, the demographic transition would take longer.
Yeah. Although draconian, there was an article in today's The New York Times that put another shine on that. Yeah. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Onur Uras, and I have actually three questions. The first one is rather quick. In the graph you presented to us, the trade between China and sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. there was a slight fall in 2008 mm-hmm. in both ways, and I was wondering what the reason for that was. The second question I have is, African borders have been laid out pretty much during the colonial period, and they did not really pay attention to the ethnic realities on the ground. Mm-hmm. With resources being shared with more of the population and democracy kind of extending mm-hmm. becoming more important throughout the continent, mm-hmm. do you see a prospect for balkanization of parts of Africa and how that would affect the development? And the third one I have is also this rapid population growth. Wouldn't that be counterproductive for the wealth of the sub-Saharan Africa in the future? Thank you.
Great. Okay, so I think the fall in trade in 2008-09 wasn't restricted just to Africa-China trade, but with the global economic crisis and recession, that affected trade patterns globally. So I think it just reflects, you know, the broader climate. The point about borders and ethnicity is one that gets a lot of attention. It's a very important issue. There are major ethnic groups divided across countries, and there have been a number of countries, in a number of cases, people have argued that the resulting ethnic divisions have weakened institutions, that there's a lack of coherence in many African countries, that the lack of an ethnic identity or the lack of a natural nation state has made them made their institutions less effective. That doesn't mean that there can't be a national identity that is built on top of those divisions. And I think, you know, so one of the cases people talk about is the case of Tanzania, which is one of the most diverse countries, but where in the decades after independence, there was a very concerted effort through the educational system, through language policy, to create a strong sense of national belonging to the Tanzania nation. But I don't, maybe I missed your point.
That's my point. Like, for example, in Kenya, every time there's an election, following the election, there's an ethnic crisis between the rural and the people.
Sure. Hopefully not this year.
Hopefully not this year. So can that become, with democracy becoming more and more prominent in the continent, can that become a...
Even worse.
Yes.
I've done some research on this together with Dan Posner, who's a political scientist at MIT. We wrote a paper. We collected opinion surveys across a couple dozen African countries. And we looked at the timing of those surveys relative to elections. And it turns out a few months before and a few months after a competitive election, democratic election in sub-Saharan Africa, feelings of ethnic attachment, ethnic identity are much higher than they are 2 years away from an election. That's almost certainly precisely because what you said, that you know, politicians may find it beneficial to activate their ethnic base during elections to try to get votes. The hope is that that is something that will occur in these first few democratic elections, and then over time, cross-ethnic alliances and coalitions will be built, or parties that span different groups will be built, and we'll have more stability. That's still an open question. But there's no doubt that in the short run, at least, when you have new democracies, the opening up of the political system has, in some cases, inflamed ethnic divisions. I mean, that's 100% the case in the data. The rapid population growth is an important point, and you know, if we look at Chinese growth as a contrast, you know, a country that very quickly reduced population growth, you know, there's no doubt that that's part of the reason why they've grown so quickly. So you have a country right now with almost no young people. I'm exaggerating. You know, one child for every couple, a lot of working age people, very few old and very few young. So it's not that surprising that investment is high and growth is high. Economic demographers. Have said there's a downside of the Chinese approach, which is when the current working age population gets old, the dependency ratio, so the number of elderly or young to working age population, is going to skyrocket faster than we've ever seen in human history. It's almost certain that Chinese growth is going to slow dramatically in the next 20 years. They just can't sustain this.
That is for sure. One child per couple is not a sustainable system, but also seven children per family is not a sustainable system.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, the question is, I guess the point I'm making is even there are some policies that over several decades have benefits, but you know, even they come with costs. And the sort of fertility situation in sub-Saharan Africa, as I alluded to before, is one of gradual decline. Again, in the short to medium run, if that decline was faster, we'd almost certainly have faster growth. I mean, I think that's
I'm John Weiss. To achieve a meaningful increase in agricultural productivity, will you need a consolidation of small farms and an entry by corporate farmers?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's been tremendous interest in farmland in sub-Saharan Africa. So there's, you know, huge tracts of farmland that foreign investors have been interested in. You know, there was this famous case in Madagascar a few years ago, but it's true in Ethiopia and a bunch of other countries. I don't know if anybody has an answer to that question, just to, you know, to be honest with you. There's a lot of policy effort today being put into improving the productivity of smallholders. The logic being that over the short to medium run, most people in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa are going to be smallholders, going to be peasant farmers. And so there's a tremendous effort to improve their productivity. Well, you know, some efforts are going into improving access to inputs, fertilizer, improved seeds. Sometimes that comes through a microfinance type approach. There are, you know, a number of government interventions to try to subsidize those inputs, as well as nonprofits that are working to basically provide subsidized credit for those inputs. So there's a lot of policy energy right now to innovate in that sector to try to make smallholders more productive. Certainly, with all the economic growth we're seeing outside of the ag sector, in cities and manufacturing, mines, et cetera, that serves as a natural pull of workers out of agriculture into those sectors. What's going to happen? What the ag sector will look like in 20 or 30 years is a little bit unclear. So, there are large-scale plantations throughout sub-Saharan Africa that are very productive and are sort of at world productivity levels. And there's a lot of international interest in African farmland. So I think the trend is in that direction, but it's still nascent. So too hard to say. And I wouldn't say that it's impossible to boost productivity quite a bit among smallholders. If we think about the Green Revolution experience in India, that was a case where improvements in inputs led to very large improvements in productivity and improved living standards among peasant farmers in India. So if that kind of experience can be replicated in sub-Saharan Africa, you could get large productivity gains without consolidation. Now, maybe consolidation would lead to even larger productivity gains, but the policy energy is more, the public policy energy is more in smallholders. There's a lot of private investment attention on larger purchases.
I might add that at the level of the multinational institutions' viewpoint on agriculture, in particular, there's a group called CGIAR, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. They have been pressing for the last 10 years to try to figure out ways to move research, particularly genetic research, not away from, but a company, but not just focusing on the five main feed grains in the world, which you can probably close your eyes and do off the top of your head, corn, rice, wheat, and then soy, and then one other which escapes me right now. And starting to look at things like yams and grains that are traditionally grown in Africa, and trying to figure out ways that they can turn a green or platinum or silver revolution into those type of things, which benefit smallholders in particular. But that is one thing to just keep your eye on. other sort of thing that this brings up, Ted, is the old Jared Diamond question of guns, germs, and steel, which, as many of you may remember, posited that some of the things that allowed civilization writ large to grow in essentially the Middle East and Europe had to do with geography and the happenstance. And the happenstance being that no large domestic animals are in Africa, and they were all started in Europe, in a sense. And that was one of the things, a harbinger of civilization. The other point being that east-west geography at a temperate climate allowed the development of cereals, which could easily go across. Yeah. I think arguably today, Africa, even though it started out with these impediments, may not have that because of technology and the fact that everyone can essentially have access to these today. I mean, cattle are in Africa after all.
Yeah, exactly. So, the livestock point is interesting. Because of trypanosomiasis, sleeping sickness, there were large sections of eastern and southern Africa that until 1920s had limited livestock, had limited cattle because of trypanosomiasis. And so a health improvement had an economic impact there. I mean, the point on technology, I think transportation infrastructure is important. So I mentioned Kenyan flower farms. They get flowers, and this is true in Ethiopia as well, to Europe overnight on airplanes. So it doesn't really matter that, if you're landlocked, it doesn't matter if you don't have navigable rivers or whatnot. With modern air transport, you can overcome a lot of those barriers. So that's helping sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, that's great. Question over there.
Hi.
Sorry.
I'm curious about some of the benefits of China's investment on the continent. We saw in the growth over the past 10 years. Also, though, some of the detriments of them flooding the market with cheap materials and how that might affect the manufacturing sector that was there. For example, I know in Nigeria, they had a pretty big sector that produced a lot of wax cloth, and in the past decade, China has been, you know, importing that same material at half the price, and it's kind of ruined their marketing sector there. So I'm curious, to what extent will Africa be able to shift from exporting just raw materials to have bringing some of the added or value added part of the manufacturing back on the continent, and how you see that playing out?
I think that's a great question. And in some of the research that's come out in the last few years, there's been a tension on the manufacturing sector. So there's some sectors that are doing relatively well. I talked about, you know, Kenya and certain sectors in Kenya. You know, there's been decent performance in textiles in Kenya, let's say. But in other sectors, much less so. And the data show that growth in manufacturing in sub-Saharan Africa is much slower than overall economic growth over the last decade. So there's been this good decade. And one of the questions, I was at a conference at the NBR a couple years ago on exactly this, and one of the questions was, how much of Africa's growth is commodity driven? Like, there are really high global commodity prices right now. And how much of it is due to improvements in total factor productivity, as economists would call it, say manufacturing productivity. And I think the consensus is a lot is coming from high commodity prices. Now, with continued growth in Asia, the feeling is commodity prices are going to stay high for a while, or at least, you know, there's a good chance of that. So it may not be fatal, but there hasn't been the kind of improvement in manufacturing productivity that we'd like to see. In Nigeria, you mentioned Nigeria, you know, Nigeria lacks petroleum refining capacity, and it's just an obvious, there would be an obvious investment in value, you know, to increase value added. And because of political impediments and certain vested interests in Nigeria, there's been a lot of resistance to investing in refining, which would be so obvious given how much they produce. So that's a bit of a warning sign. I mean, there was a question before about the negatives, and I think one of the negatives, that's one of the warning signs. There isn't as much productivity growth as we'd like to see. And in that sense, growth in sub-Saharan Africa is very different than earlier growth in some of the Asian tiger economies, which were powered by just very rapid improvements in manufacturing productivity. So that's a warning sign. And the other concern or cloud on the horizon is really climate change, because when we're talking about agricultural productivity and the importance of all these policy changes for the smallholder, climate change could render a lot of that moot. So.
What about the possibilities of applying genetic engineering to plant development? Like some companies like Monsanto have very successfully done in India, tailoring the problems in India, developing things and working with local seed companies to improve the output. Is there a possibility of that in sub-Saharan Africa?
There is. There's a big push right now, and this is a bit of what was being alluded to before. Both public sector institutions like the CGIAR group and private sector firms are working very actively in this area to have the new African Green Revolution. And it's been a major policy focus the last maybe 5-6 years. So I think there is hope that with enough investment and scientific progress, we can develop better varieties. Again, the constraint you face in sub-Saharan Africa, because it is a north-south facing continent, getting back to the Jared Diamond argument, is innovations that work in one climate zone may not work in another, and you have so many climate zones. So in that sense, China, Eurasia has a major advantage, because stuff that was developed in the Middle East could go to Europe, it could go to East Asia with sort of minor modifications. So, but that, a lot of people have pointed to that as one of the keys to continued increases in African living standards. I'm not an ag scientist, so I don't know what the prospects are technically, but there's interest and money going.
What is the water situation as far as agriculture and all these masses of people being born, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so water, you know, the sort of water situation is very different than most parts of Asia, in that irrigated agriculture is rare in sub-Saharan Africa, and it remains rare. So sometimes to build irrigation systems, it takes time, it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of infrastructure. You know, in South Asia, there tens of thousands of dams, from small, medium to large dams, that are really irrigation dams. And, you know, there was decades of investment that led to the creation of that system of dams, which allowed for local irrigation. And there's been no such effort in sub-Saharan Africa. So I think by all measures, you know, only single digit percentage of farmland is irrigated in sub-Saharan Africa. partially, you know, part of this is sub-Saharan Africa is most of sub-Saharan Africa is semi-arid, so you don't have as abundant water. But there also just hasn't been the public infrastructure investment or private infrastructure investment in irrigation infrastructure. So it remains a big issue. And that means African farmers are subject to much larger year-to-year fluctuations in productivity due to weather shocks, because they can't smooth out, say, rainfall shocks with irrigation. So it really, it heightens the vulnerability of African farmers.
Yes, please.
Hi, Ford Johnson. So when you led with a chart pretty early on that showed the revolutionary post-colonial period of the 60s and the 70s, and there was a period of sort of chaos. And then this last decade has been promising.
Yeah.
So you had sort of maybe a revolutionary generation and succeeded by a technocratic generation of leadership.
Yeah.
But it's kleptocracy, which sort of seemed to be a plague, been dropped in the process.
Yeah.
In that evolution.
Kleptocracy?
Kleptocracy.
Yeah.
Transparency in government, quality of governance generally, as well as just straight up corruption.
Yeah, I mean, every measure of corruption, if you take regional averages, put sub-Saharan Africa at the bottom. Part of that may be related to the fact that these are new countries with new institutions. And one of the comments before related to the fact that these were nations with largely arbitrary borders, frankly, where groups with different political traditions were thrown together. Constitutions in the early 60s were basically written in Europe, frankly. They weren't written indigenously, for the most part. So you have a population that's being handed a constitution and a set of institutions that are foreign in many ways. And it's taken time. I mean, it's taken decades now for those institutions to acquire some legitimacy, for people to come up with their own political coalitions and compromises and sort of ways of doing business politically. And we're still in the middle of that process. Even a country like Kenya, which is not one of the laggards, still has political instability around elections, because they haven't fully sorted out how to work on transfers of power. So I think we're seeing this process of institutional growth and the rise of democracy and competitive elections and free media as part of the consolidation of institutions. But we're sort of midstream. And there are historical antecedents. You know, when Latin American countries became independent in the 1810s, 1820s, it was really only 60 years later, 70 years later, in the late 1800s, where you started having much more consolidated states. So the 1800s in Latin America were a period of cross-country wars, civil wars, political instability with new countries. And maybe in sub-Saharan Africa, they're going to have to go through the same process of nation building. But the bad economic policies pursued by kleptocrats and the corruption is central to any narrative on African underperformance in the 70s and 80s.
And presumably, I think I heard you say continue.
And continues with some improvement. So some corruption measures are improving. Some measures of economic policy are improving. Measures of political competition are improving. So we're seeing the beginnings of change, really, since the political opening in the 1990s. But it's an ongoing process.
You know, you used one of my favorite oxymorons in your presentation, which was U.S. economic leadership. Now, arguably, U.S.
Have we sunk so low?
No. I mean, arguably, all the stats are that we are still the largest economy by GDP,
right.
And that, in fact, individually, our global, our U.S. companies that are part, you know, heavily into the global 1,000 companies or global 500, however you want to count it, are show a lot of leadership. But when I look at what I understand is happening with respect to China and looking at their resource needs in Africa and Latin America, there is no similar engagement from a State Department standpoint that's at least overt. And I don't know whether there should be or not, but that vacuum is, you know, if vacuum can be loud,
sure. One of the interesting things about Chinese investment in Africa is most of the firms investing are state-owned enterprises.
Yeah.
And so there is some level of inherent coordination with policymakers in that case that you wouldn't see with private U.S. firms to the same degree. And I think that's right. Another graph I was going to put on, but I trimmed for the sake of time, was another projection on the share of world GDP in different regions going forward. And so the U.S. share right now of global GDP is a little over 20%. Mm-hmm. but 50 years from now it'll be more like 11%.
Right.
So we are, and Europe's going to kind of fall even further. So we're in the middle of an important transition.
Implications from your perspective for U.S. Policymakers, whether that's the supervisors of Alameda County or the Congress or Senate?
I'm not sure. I don't think, at least the projections don't show that there'll be any one country that will have as large a share of the world economy as the U.S. has had historically. So in the 1950s, the U.S. was a third of world GDP, and we've been shrinking ever since. But a third for one country is just amazing. China's never going to get to that point, in part because their population is just plummeting. I mean, their population's going to fall in absolute terms starting very soon. So we're going to have people have talked about the multipolar world, but it seems like that's certainly the direction we're headed in. And sub-Saharan Africa is going to be one of those important poles, just given their population size and rising incomes.
Yes, sir.
Perry Irvine. What do you think it's going to take to get the rule of law fully integrated into the political systems in Africa over the next 10, 20 years? And I speak from, I've been going to Africa since 2004 with the International Senior Lawyers Project, involved with rule of law, human rights, and ethics, and whatnot.
That's a hard question, and that probably the very long-lasting, persistent changes in rule of law are going to be internally generated. There's been a lot of attention among donors, the USAIDs, the World Banks, and whatnot, in improving governance over the last decade. And one of the things we can provide is technical expertise, which sounds like the sort of thing your group is providing. You know, some lawyers or those with legal training here sharing our experiences and helping to transfer that knowledge elsewhere. But that's really only the beginning. You know, the blueprint isn't enough. These institutions and these legal codes have to be integrated. And that's going to happen through a political process. And those changes will have the most legitimacy through a democratic political process. So, on one level, the rise of democracy makes it more likely that you would get consolidation of rule of law that's really persistent and permanent, because the kinds of changes that are pursued will have legitimacy. Kenya, I'm going to come back to Kenya just because I know it best. You know, 2 years ago, there was a referendum on a major constitutional reform that had major legal implications, reorganized local governments, changed the rights, inheritance rights for women, did a whole range of changes, also strengthened the judiciary. So again, talking about rule of law, that process had been going on literally for decades, the discussion of that constitutional reform. But it's only now that democracy is starting to be consolidated in Kenya that it was finally that the major parties sat down, agreed on a blueprint, put it up to vote, it passed overwhelmingly. But I think Kenya's a good case. So we've actually been able to see a case where changes happened. And it wasn't imposed by outsiders. I mean, outsiders provided guidance, technical expertise, and it took 20 years to finally push through. But now that it's been voted on with mass, you know, large majority supporting a 70% majority, maybe now it'll stick. But it's a long, fraught process. Kind of getting back to this point about how long it takes to build institutions. It's not going to be one day to the next. It's a decade-long process, but we're finally starting to see the fruits of that process in Africa with economic progress.
You know, I'd like, just for my own edification, maybe we'll generate another question. How many people in the audience have been to Africa? Could you raise your... So I'm in a distinct minority here. I was calculating today. I don't know how far Gibraltar is. Is it 20 miles, 15 miles? The closest I've been.
Southern Africa.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly. But that's really great. It shows level of interest. Now, those of you who haven't had a question, who raise your hand, I'm sure there's a question out there. Yes.
Yeah, this is a very controversial area, and there is some research suggesting, for instance, that countries that receive a lot of foreign aid actually have a slowing of growth in their manufacturing sector. Maybe, you know, resources are getting pulled into the NGO and nonprofit sector and away from the private sector. So that could have negative consequences. At the same time, we can point to lots of successes generated by aid, you know, whether it's subsidizing antiretroviral treatment to keep millions of people alive. That just has to be a, you know, huge success of U.S. foreign aid in terms of saved lives. And even outside the bilaterals or multilaterals, all the NGOs and nonprofits, some of whom are doing very innovative programs, are certainly having an impact. But I think, honestly, the research would say the jury's still out on the long-term impacts of aid. And if you don't have the sort of political buy-in and the political support for reform, then it's not clear aid is having any sort of permanent effect. It may benefit people in the short run, alleviating poverty, food aid, and other things, but it's not clear you're going to get the kinds of institutional changes or policy reforms you need from aid alone, even in some kind of local line. So my own views, I see myself sort of in the middle of this debate where I'm kind of agnostic about it, but there are very loud voices on the extremes.
So the interesting thing is in the last 10 years, there have been two completely different approaches to aid, and Africa's been one of the areas which has been you've seen that most. One is when the Bush, this is my personal point of view, Bush administration sort of has an in-your-face to the traditional way that USAID used to work, created the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which essentially said, okay, we're going to decide which of these 10 countries is eligible. And eligibility had to do with a variety of things, including, you know, higher levels of rule of law than others, and said, okay, now we're going to do a $500 million program for you, and you internally are going to have to go through a one-year process of deciding where this money is going to be spent, as opposed to the USAID way, which was saying, we got $10 million for this project. And the other one, which is fascinating, was who took leadership, was the Gates Foundation. The Gates Foundation decided that perhaps the best way to parcel out money was to bypass governments entirely to the extent you can, so that there you automatically took out one of the pockets in which the money would fall into. Would you agree with that analysis? And what do you think about the three approaches?
I think the MCC approach was interesting. It was very different. I mean, the Bush administration definitely tried to go around the traditional foreign aid bureaucracy with MCC, Millennium Challenge Corporation, with PEPFAR, which was the main funder of antiretrovirals. So they didn't strengthen traditional, they didn't try to bolster traditional bilateral means. The Obama administration has gone back to strengthening USAID and trying to innovate within USAID. Yeah. So they've supported a number of innovations in USAID, one of which was appointing Steve Radelet, who I mentioned, to create the Office of the Chief Economist and have a little bit more of an integrated vision. So,
well, and also and more integration filing.
Much more integration.
As well, state, which is huge. Because,
right.
In fact,
right.
If we do have any coordination, it's not through our Commerce Department, but it's
right.
State right now.
That's right. Yeah. And in terms of the Gates Foundation, I would never utter a negative word about them since they're a big funder of our research. So, but what I do like about dealing with the Gates Foundation is they've been very evidence-oriented. So as a researcher, you know, the fact that, and I don't know if this flows from Bill Gates' experience in business or in engineering or what it is, but there's a culture of evidence and wanting to see hard benefits with data and whatnot that appeals to us as researchers and I think is a good way forward. And that's actually been one of the big trends in development, on the development practitioner side, has been an increasing attention, I think, to evaluation, impact evaluation that didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. And the center that I direct at Berkeley has been trying to promote that agenda. Because if we don't know what works and what doesn't, then how are we going to allocate aid effectively or know what policies are successful? It seems so obvious when you say it, but there were just decades of aid being given. It gets back to your point about USAID, this kind of patchwork way with little coordination, little evidence, with lots of different constituencies pushing policy A, B, C, and D when people didn't know what was having an impact. So we're moving away from that model, and academics like our group are trying to play a role in generating that evidence.
Well, you're not alone. I was really struck about a year ago when I went through and looked at major universities around the U.S. and how many of them have centers, much like yours, which are actually teaching in particular undergraduates about what how development might be done.
There's been a huge change in the economics profession. You know, when I did my PhD at Harvard, out of 20-something PhDs in my year, I was the only person doing international development. Mm-hmm. And I was basically discouraged from doing it. And now, all around the country, as you said, there's interest at the undergrad level, the master's level. There's all these new master's programs in development policy, including a new one starting next year at Berkeley, PhD level. So maybe as the U.S. share of global GDP shrinks and shrinks, we realize we need to engage more with the rest of the world.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our time, according to my handler over there. And thank you for joining us. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to ask you to join me in thanking Ted McGill for your excellent talk and the discussion. Thanks for all your audience.